So if I can start by introducing the first of our panel of speakers, Professor Ross Anderson, who I've known, I didn't say for many years, Ross, but for several years now, and have shared platforms with on a number of occasions. Ross Anderson is Professor of Security Engineering at the University of Cambridge and a Fellow of the Royal Society. He's one of the founders of an academic discipline, the Economics of Information Security. And it's hard to imagine a more eminent speaker in this area that I could introduce to you. He's a technical expert, yes, but I would say much more than a technical expert, because he's concerned about the wider implications of the collection and use of personal information. He was one of the authors of a report on the database state, the increasing collection of databases by the government, which I'm sure he'll refer to. He's looking these days at issues such as smart metering. And I have to say, Ross, you've been a critic of our office as well from time to time, and I'm sure you won't be holding back necessarily this evening just because I'm here. But you can be sure that when you hear from Ross, you're hearing from an expert who has spent many years in this field and views it from a very wide perspective and brings a very broad range of views. So, Ross, it's a great pleasure to introduce you to speak to our audience.
Thanks, David. Thank
you. We're engineers here, most of us. I certainly think of myself as an engineer. And engineering for privacy is a bit like engineering for security or dependability, in that it involves a number of disciplines. Engineering involves the underlying science, which in the case of privacy is largely computer science, where we can get useful lessons on things such as scalability. How do privacy problems get better or worse as we add more users to our systems? Like most engineering disciplines, it also involves economics. Any fool can build a bridge, but the guy who can build it with less steel and concrete than the other guy is the guy who gets the tender. Now, in the case of security and privacy, the economics are somewhat more complex, but there's a key insight here, which is that systems often fail when the people who maintain them have the wrong incentives. If Alice is guarding a vault, but it's Bob's goods in the vault, then Alice will perhaps not be as vigilant a sentry as Bob would have been. And finally, there's psychology. Usability is more and more important, and more attacks on systems involve some kind of deception or fraud. In particular, there's a growing gap between the feeling and the reality. In a number of fields, security is one, and privacy is certainly one of these. Now, privacy is hard because all three of these factors are often pushing the wrong way at the same time. How does that come about? Well, there are two sides to this story, basically. How does privacy work itself out in the context of a business? What sort of privacy do you have against your bank or against Google or against Facebook? And the second side is, of course, the public sector, the NHS, the police, the spooks, the child protection people, and so on and so forth. But let's start off with business. Now, ever since we've had markets, perhaps 10,000 years ago when we invented agriculture and started having a surplus, people have found that it's efficient to charge different prices to different people. The carpet trader in Istanbul who says, "Effendi, I make a very special price just for you," is doing a routine that has been going on since as long as we've had cities. Why is it efficient? Well, if my students and I are prepared to write a report on a new smart card for, say, £10,000, and Barclays will pay £8,000 and Lloyds will pay £4,000, then if I have to sell to everybody at the same price, then no deal can be done. I can get one lot of £8,000 or two lots of £4,000, so we won't do the work. But if I can sell for different prices, if I can sell to Barclays for £8,000 and Lloyds for £4,000, then things can happen. So there's a Pareto improvement. There is economic efficiency there. Now, we see this all around us. We see first versus business versus economy class tickets. We see goods priced at various price points. But what's changing is basically two things. Firstly, as you get falling costs of collecting and processing data, it becomes easier to price discriminate. Right? If you're Tesco and you've got the information from the club card, then you know precisely what sort of discounts you should be offering to which people to get them to shop more with you. It's no longer a method of crudely discriminating between the people who buy the value brands and the people who buy the luxury brands, or between the people who will spend money to save time and the people who will spend time to save money. You can discriminate much more finely because you have got all this information sitting in your databases. The second thing that's changing is that as goods around us get more and more software in them, and as manufacturing processes become more automated, so you find that the marginal cost of producing a good comes down, and the capital cost, the cost involved in designing it and tooling up for it, becomes greater. Now, Economics 101 says that if you've got a competitive market, then the clearing price is going to be the marginal cost of production. So this means that it's ever more difficult to recoup your investment if you have to sell to everybody at the same price, and instead you have to try and sell to value, as they say. So at the same time as we're making it easier to do price discrimination, we are creating stronger incentives on businesses to do that. And ultimately, businesses become more and more like the software business, or the airline business, or the hotel business, or any of the other businesses which have got low marginal costs of production. So far, so good, but there's a downside to price discrimination, which is that we all hate it. If you're sitting in an EasyJet going down to the south of France for your holiday and you paid 60 quid for your ticket and you find that the person sitting next to you paid £29 because they booked a week earlier, then you're going to be upset. And if the guy sitting next to you paid 130 quid because he only booked his ticket last Tuesday, then he's also going to be upset to find out that you're both riding much more cheaply than he is. And there is a long history of public disquiet with price discrimination, going right back to the railways in the 1840s. And of course, it's rational, because if you're a business, you're going to charge people who've got a bit more money more for your products. And if you earn a little bit above the national average, as I presume most people here do, being qualified engineers or on the way there, then you're going to be a victim of this predatory pricing more often than not. So logically, you might be thinking about ways in which you might avoid it or lobby against it. Now, as things go online and networks become social, things become even more involved. A good example is Facebook. Now, people often say that privacy of commercial systems doesn't matter because participation is voluntary. Well, speak to your kids or to your students. As my students put it to me, all the party invitations in Cambridge nowadays come out on Facebook. So if you're not on Facebook, you won't get to go to any parties, you won't meet any girls, you won't have any sex, you won't have any kids, and so your genes will die out. There is a Darwinian imperative. The Facebook non-user genes are going to be extirpated from the earth in two generations' time. So we've got this system with 500 million users, and the users aren't the customers. If you use Facebook, you're the product, right? The customers are the advertisers. And Facebook makes money by selling your eyeballs, your mindshare, to its advertisers. So what it wants is for you to put all your personal information onto Facebook so they've got lots of information to sell. In order to get you to do that, they design their system to provide a feeling of intimacy, the feeling that you're working in a small group, that you're communicating only with your friends, and that you've got some social control, both personally and as a group. And of course, this isn't reflected in the reality of the system. And how Facebook have implemented it is to have arranged that there are very complex access controls with dozens, scores of settings on many pages. And they don't give you much information about privacy. They don't make it salient. They don't want you to think about it. Now, the great majority of people never change the defaults, and so as a result, when they think they're sharing information with their friends, they're also sharing it with their advertisers and the rest of the world. When something happens, when the advertisers do something particularly egregious, Facebook can turn around and say, oh, silly you, you forgot to block non-friends searching your stuff. You should have checked box number 14 on page number 4. So somehow or another, it's never Facebook's fault. I think we can expect more and more systems to be like this, and I think you can understand now why this is so. The commercial incentives are so strong, and in the case of a firm like Facebook, there is in effect lock-in, right? It is a natural monopoly. You want to be on the social network that your friends are on. So the question will arise in due course about whether there should be some kind of regulation of this. And if so, whether it's done at the European level or the national level or whatever. So there are some examples of how the economics of the matter drive privacy and cause some really wicked and intractable problems. On the computer science side, one of the things that we're interested in as computer scientists is scaling. And in many systems, the typical privacy threat is from insiders. Consider medical information, for example. In the old world, your medical records sat in your GP's surgery, where a dozen staff had access to perhaps 10,000 records. You know, brown paper records sitting on a big carousel in the surgery's library. We can just about cope with that. Perhaps every other GP would have a privacy issue once in their career, but it was at a level that society could cope with. But what happens if all of a sudden you let 45,000 GPs and a similar number of staff see 50 million records? Suppose you put all the records in one big jukebox. Well, they tried that in Scotland with a thing called the emergency care record, and the next thing they found, there was a doctor in Melrose went and downloaded the records of Gordon Brown, Alex Salmon, Kirsty Wark, assorted footballers, celebrities, and so on. And government fluttered around for a while and eventually decided it wouldn't be in the public interest to prosecute him. So we've got a problem there with scaling. If you might occasionally have one bad person in a dozen, you're certainly going to have one bad person at least all the time if you've got tens of thousands of people who have access. So some things just cannot safely be scaled. Now, the intelligence agencies have learned their lessons here. In fact, they have to learn the lesson again every generation or two. They learned during World War II that it was a good idea to keep intelligence information compartmented in little boxes so that people only had access to stuff that they needed to do their job. After 9/11, they started putting it in one big pot again. They said the intelligence community must share its information so that we can catch the bad guys. And now, of course, there's the WikiLeaks thing. 400,000 combat reports from Iraq leaked by one disgruntled private first class. So they're going to go back to compartmentation again. Is this something that can be solved by technology? No, it isn't. It's something that is more in the line of a temptation that technology puts in the way of the heedless designer. And so we're going to see again and again and again that personal information is put in boxes that are too large, which as a result leak information sometimes catastrophically and have to be redesigned. Again, what sort of governance can we expect to mitigate this kind of problem? So there's the commercial side in brief. Now, as David said, there's also the government side. And some colleagues and I, Angela and I and four colleagues, wrote a report that was published by the Joseph Rowntree Reform Trust in March last year entitled Database State, which you can download free from our website or from theirs. And what the Rowntree folks asked us to do was to look at all the British government systems and at relevant European systems that hold information on all of us, or at least in a substantial minority of us. And the question that we were asking was whether these databases are legal and effective. And the subtext was, as there was a general election due within a year or so, what systems should the next government scrap, which should it keep, and which should it fix? Now, you may recall at the time there had been some kerfuffle over HMRC, There were people who were demonstrating about ID cards, and a number of us had written a report on children's databases for the Information Commissioner, which pointed out that some of these databases brought European law. The idea behind this project was to get an overall view, to go from department to department and draw up a list of systems that we should be concerned about. So we found 46 suitable large systems, and we found that 11 of them were almost certainly illegal. As examples of those that we found were illegal, the Department of Health maintains a database called the Secondary Uses Service, which has got summaries in there of all finished consultant episodes in secondary care. That's every time you've been to hospital, what was wrong with you, what was done, how much it cost, who the surgeon was, things like that. And it's beginning to get summaries from GP records as well. This is primarily used for administration. It's usually justified to the public as being useful for research. There was also another system then called the Detailed Care Record. Now it's being renamed, the idea of which was to share information between GPs and other local providers such as social work, hospitals, and so on. Now, these fell foul of a judgment, IV Finland, which I'll discuss later, a judgment of the European Court of Human Rights, which says that we as European citizens have got the right to restrict our personal health information to those clinicians who are involved directly in our care. Therefore, the government doesn't have the right to maintain a database like this and not give us the ability to opt out. On the kids' front, there are a number of databases there. ECAF is a system used by social workers to record details of kids who've got some welfare requirements. ONSET is a system that attempts to predict which kids will fall foul of the law. So they accumulate points, for example, whether you live in a bad area, whether you had problems at school, whether you had ADHD, whether your daddy was ever in jail, and so on and so forth. And they try to come to a view of whether you will end up being up to no good. This falls foul of the law because it stigmatizes people, similarly to the stigmatization that people from ethnic minorities and so on used to suffer. And then there was a kids' database contact point, which was like the National Identity Register, but for kids, which had details of all children in Britain, together with details of which public services they were in contact with. So it became apparent, for example, which children were in contact with social services. That was actually closed down on the 8th of August after both the Conservative and Lib Dem parties decided in their manifestos that it was to be discontinued. In the Home Office, there were problems with the National DNA database, the National Identity Register, which has since also been closed down, sort of, and the Interception Modernization Programme, which is a scheme promoted by GCHQ to collect large quantities of communications data from ISPs and the like so that they can tell who has been in contact with whom. And there were various other bits and pieces as well in DWP and at the European level. What was also interesting is that we found a number of databases which we rated amber. Many of these were databases that didn't do much good or indeed didn't seem to do any good at all. Britain's got a national childhood obesity database, for example, of all kids who are fat. What was this for? It was so that the government could decide what size of bonuses to pay to the managers leading various health improvement initiatives. Well, given that the government supposedly has no money left for public information campaigns, how come we've still got a national childhood obesity database? Why not just pull the plug and throw it on the skip? The NHS also has something called a summary care record, a project that was built supposedly to have all your allergies and medications, in case an ambulance man needed to know. But there already is a perfectly workable system, MedAlert. You know, those are the people who give you a bracelet or a card if you're diabetic. So this was an extra purposeless system that was being built by people at the Department of Health. Then there's a national pupil database. This has got a large amount of information about your kids at school, what sort of exam results they've got, what sort of detentions they've had, one thing and another. It's supposedly useful for something. We don't quite know what, because the schools themselves, if a child goes from one school to another, the school will want the sending school's records, not something from the government. So large numbers of central databases had been built, which weren't really doing much good and which did have the potential for privacy harm. The shocking thing was that of the 46 databases we looked at, only six of them got a green light, and one of those was an error. The National Fingerprint Database had in fact been condemned by the European Court and we hadn't noticed it, despite trying to read all this stuff. So hey, that was the state of play a year and a half ago. So where are we now? Well, three red systems have been closed down: the identity cards system, Contact Point, and the National Audit Office, which was doing some data matching that they shouldn't have been doing. Other red systems, well, they're persisting. They're being renamed the Internet, Interception Modernization Program. It now seems is going to be with us, for example. And we've got two systems, which we would have to rate as red were we writing the report again. The summary care record, which is growing like Topsy, and the youth justice case management system. And we still have a large number of these amber systems which don't do any good, but which still chew money and which can still do privacy harm. So in short, we're getting no real change. Why is this? Well, it's because government faces the same kind of incentives that business face. Government wants to personalize government. Ministers want to be able to target benefits at floating voters. They want to be able to tax the other side's voters like mad, and they want to be able to tax their own loyal voters a bit. That's your optimal strategy. And just like Tesco, they feel that information is useful for it. What's proposed to be done about it? Well, government talks about statistical security, about taking people's names and addresses off these databases. The problem is that that doesn't work very well, because if you have more than a small amount of information about somebody on a database, it's usually possible to re-identify them. For example, suppose I want to find out the salary of the lady professor in our department. Even if I'm not allowed to make inquiries about single individuals, I can say what's the average salary for all professors and what's the average salary for all male professors, and bingo, I can deduce the result. You can do tricks like this and many, many more in health databases. Let me skip economics of privacy as we are in our last couple of minutes. And I'll just conclude by saying that privacy online is hard. The economics, psychology, and computer science are often pushing in the wrong direction. The private sector, we understand its motivation very, very well, its price discrimination. The public sector is somewhat similar, although the details, as always, are different. Personalized service, transformational government, or whatever. And so there's a big question here. Who sets the boundary? Is it going to be European law, public reaction against creepy organizations, or rational rejection of surveillance by richer citizens? Now, if I were a gambling man, I would suspect that European law may be eventually what fixes it. And to wrap up, let me just mention the IV Finland case, which went final in the European Court of Human Rights in 2008. Ms. I was a nurse in the university hospital in Helsinki, and she was HIV positive. The computer systems there, like the ones now being put in the NHS, let every clinician see every patient's records. So all her nursing colleagues could see that she was HIV positive because she was also a patient at the hospital. So they hounded her out of her job. So she sued for wrongful dismissal, and the court in Finland said, nope, government set the regulations for this and the database abides by them. So she went to Strasbourg, and the justices there said, nope, hang on, Mr. Finland, you can't do that. Ms. I had the right to restrict her health records to the clinicians involved directly in her care, and you didn't support that, so you've got to pay her compensation. So what I suspect is going to happen is that case by case, in fields, we've already seen it in DNA and in healthcare, we'll see it in other fields, we're going to find this becoming, in effect, part of our constitutional law as a result of decisions by the European Court. And that, I think, is going to be very uncomfortable for certain parts of government, because if you run a department, Department of Health, Department of Education, that has gone and invested hundreds of millions of pounds in computer systems and much more in supporting operational procedures that are predicated on the idea that you can put information into big pots, and you're suddenly compelled to change that by the European Court, then that's going to be hugely disruptive. And this, I think, is going to be a significant part of the future for privacy in Britain. Thanks.
Well, thanks very much, Ross. You've certainly given us some food for thought there. It'll be interesting when we come to the discussion whether everybody agrees that it's Europe coming to the rescue or whether it's Europe that's the problem here. I mean, you also touched on an issue that came to my attention recently in a conference that I was at, this question of anonymisation. Is it any longer possible to anonymise information, particularly a challenge for the research community? And if you're removing identifiers, there is so much information available in the wider world now through Google and elsewhere, and such sophisticated computing techniques. You know, there's the argument that it's always possible to reconstitute the information in one way or another in an identifiable form. Now, that might not be quite the case, but that is a real challenge we face. Is anonymisation any longer a valid concept? And maybe we'll have the opportunity to come back to that. But thanks very much, Ross, for that presentation.